So before he escapes, I'd like to thank Robert for all he's done for this event. Embarrass me. All right. I know it's been a long day for a lot of people. I guess I get that. For me, I wish it wasn't going to end. Like, this has been an absolutely amazing day. And I got to tell you, at 6 o'clock, 9 hours into it, I looked around the room and counted, and there was still 90 people in the room. And that's just amazing. That's just amazing. And I know that there's been some people that have truly been touched. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus, but I know some lives have been changed today, and that's what this is all about. That's why we're here. And I'm so grateful to be able to be a part of this. I am so extremely grateful to all the speakers that came up here. You know, and I didn't do anything but pick up the phone and ask them to come. They're the ones that put this on. You know, and Keoki and Richard are the ones that did the legwork with the cooking. And I thank everybody that helped set up. And if there's anybody that can stick around and help us clean up afterwards, that would be great. And I know everybody is ready to go besides me. and I know Pete has had a long day and would like to get up here. So we're going to let Peter come up and wrap it up with a story. Come on up, Pete.
My name is Peter, a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Peter.
And let's close with the Lord's Prayer. If God's my employer, you know, sometimes the boss asks you to work late, do a little overtime, work on a weekend, and so you do it. I was listening to Pat speak and thinking when he's done, there's going to be dinner. I'll probably get to the podium around 2 o'clock in the morning. And because we like to talk, you know, we can't be prompt. And it just came to me that, you know, I agreed to work for God, and so doing a little overtime. And I'll try to be brief here. I have no idea what I'm going to get, but you know, if you're not out, you're not out. As long as you're not high. And the little Dauphine says, "We cannot out here. How cool!" And you know, if you need to get up and or just leave, it's really cool. It's been a great day, a long day. Endurance is needed, and the spiritual path, you do need endurance, because it isn't always one of instant gratification when you're on a spiritual path, and it's in God's time. So when you do things like this, it's endurance. And, you know, the body says, "I'm going to, you know, leave and come back." I was thinking about doing that, but then you miss a speaker. And guys, when I hear speakers, you know, you think because maybe I'm a speaker, I don't need to listen to another speaker. But I don't know what I'm going to hear that might help me a little bit too, or just give me a new level of awareness. And if I can just come here and just do my talk and see you guys next week, and then maybe I stop being teachable. And that is not a good place to be. That's very deep water. June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol, and I like to say I'm a recovered alcoholic. Obviously, we get to talk about recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but also getting recovered from the things that accompany alcoholism, the untreated alcoholism. And so when I say that, I'm not trying to separate myself from anyone in the room or be unique or different. It's just my truth, currently my truth. And it's been that way for a while. And as long as I keep chopping wood and carrying wood and doing the work that's in front of me, service, a life of being a servant, it's the highest level I can go in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just where God wants me to be a servant to Him. And doing work with the spiritual disciplines, the strict spiritual disciplines of 10 and 11, and giving the whole thing away in 12 and revisiting the steps annually, there's a pretty good chance I can stay in that place called recovered. I don't own that, though. But I get to experience that and then talk about it and bear witness to being recovered. Not different, special, unique, and certainly not cured, but being in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I got to tell you, there was something, I'm in the treatment center business, and some of my clients were here, and I was telling Maren, I hope they just kind of got rocketed with some of this, and maybe the engine got turned on in the early days of recovery. They're difficult, and I am just so sometimes saddened and wondering, you know, what I do for a living. Is it even working? Am I even making a dent? We hear about the casualties of wars in our sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you're in the business I'm in, and it is a business, it isn't. I approach it with an altruistic heart, but I still get paid for it. When I was coming up, if someone OD'd, it was this, oh my God, Joe OD'd? Are you kidding me? It was this rare occurrence. We have guys coming in to treatment, had three ODs in a week. And we're burying, I'm getting reports, we're burying in my area five a week. In the town of Del Rey, last month, 40 deaths. 1 month, 40. And these are kids, 25, 24, 23, 21, 22, like that, who haven't even got a chance to taste, to smell the air yet. To me, they're babies. And if you're 25, I don't mean that in disrespectfully. It's just, you can be my grandchild almost. And we're losing them. And I'm wondering what's wrong. Are they addicts or alkies, or are they just hard drug users and hard drinkers? I don't know. But it's really disheartening to see what's going on. And are we doing our job effectively in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because some of these young folks are in the wrong fellowship. And that's not to ruffle feathers. That's, I'm going to speak my truth here. But if I'm a hardcore dope fiend and I never drank and I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm calling myself an alcoholic, I'm already starting a journey off based on a lie. And I forgot about my... And I'm going to say this for the sake of this discussion, not to break a tradition. I forgot about the cooker. And I forgot about the tying up and the spike. And when you turn on, you light a match to cook it up, that smell of the sulfur makes your stomach flip. You can't talk about that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this thing called singleness of purpose. So I have a young kid, maybe 19, 20 years old, is a hardcore dope fiend, had maybe one beer in his life, sitting in me, Alcoholics Anonymous, saying, my name is Johnny, I'm an alcoholic. No, you're not. So the whole journey is based on a lie. There's very little identification unless that group happens to be violating singleness of purpose traditions, and many groups do that because the elders aren't doing their job. And they're not lovingly taken, folks. It's easy for me to say go to another fellowship. I didn't do anything. I ordered you out of here is what I did. And I'm not talking about sending people out of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not what this means. I heard a couple of guns go click, click 2 seconds ago. That is not what I'm talking about. What I am saying is if I got a dope fiend in front of me to explain that there's another place that he can go to occasionally to identify with those type of folks, real identification, because that's what we do in here. You know, I was doing a conference, I think we were in Houston, and someone during my talk popped open a can of soda. Sounds just like a beer. And I made a joke about that, and all the alkies knew what I was talking about. A crackhead has no idea what I'm talking about because there's no identification. And I've been in AA meetings where I heard the guy got up there and spoke about smoking crack at an AA meeting, and the elders did nothing. And he's sharing about his antics on crack, and I'm going, I don't know this life. I have no idea what he's talking about. And I'm an alcoholic sitting in an AA meeting, and I'm feeling like I don't know what to do. So we owe that to each other, including the new guy who's relapsing in Alcoholics Anonymous, who's purely a dope fiend. Not kicking anyone out. Welcome. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. If the desire to stop drinking, have a seat. I'll pour you a cup of coffee. Let's talk about your story. Where are you from? What are you doing? I shot dope for 20 years. What else? That's all I do. Okay, how about I take you with a couple of guys just to expose you to another 12-step fellowship. It might set you free. Let's try it. I'll take you. I don't mean you. Don't get angry with me. You're three times bigger than me. I don't want to piss you off. Mike, start the car. Is he coming this way? So... You know, when I was first coming around, I did non-conference approved dry goods for a handful of years. It's part of my story, but I'm not an addict. I was a hard drug user, you know, did a lot of funky things. And when you get addicted, period. And then I walked it. I say I walked away from it. It's giving myself way too much credit. I was just taken away from that, but I couldn't get away from the drink or the pills. And when I first came home from Minnesota, about 11 months or so sober, my first sponsor heard my first step experience. And he says, here's what I want to do. He's clearly got the allergy and all the things that you talked about. He's, but you got a little piece in there. You got some serious drug using in there. Here's what I want you to do, and I'm going to take you. And we're going to get this guy in Brooklyn. We had a name. We had Little Danny, Big Vinny, Fat Tony, Skinny Tony. We had Jimmy Walsh. We had all these. Everyone didn't know their last name. We just knew nicknames. And about four of these guys took me down the block on a Thursday night when my home group was having a step meeting and a tradition meeting. They took me down the block to another fellowship. And they did this for me once a week. Now, for me, I knew about the using of the narcotics, but I wasn't really locking into their story and identification. When I sat in my home group of Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard an old-timer, and to me an old-timer was maybe 50 years old and had 15 years sober. That was like an old-timer. There was a guy, Tom Knight, from Brooklyn, who had like maybe 50 years at the time. He was a real old-timer. You know, he went to meetings with Bill. And I could identify with that guy's drinking, and I was a young kid. I was 29, 28, 30 maybe at the time. I can identify with that. I can identify with the handshaking and the romancing, getting thirsty for the drink. I could get that part. But that's what they did. They did at least that for me. Just in case. Let's cover everything because your life is on the line here and we're going to turn over every stone. And so the elders in AA, we have a responsibility. I go to some meetings and allow me to just a little latitude. I go to some meetings and I see, 100 young kids pull up to a meeting. It's so wonderful they're there. And I mean this sincerely because the alternative is dead. And that's why I want to reiterate again. I don't want to make this like I'm getting on a soapbox and telling a new guy, you're not welcome. You're so welcome here. But we need to investigate just a little bit further and see if I can identify more with someone else. And so I see a bunch of youngins come in. You know, the halfway house kids got that look. You just know it has a halfway house. And they come in and they sit down. They don't know they're green. They don't know traditions. They don't know etiquette, meeting etiquette. They don't know protocol. They don't know, like I didn't know. And I see a lot of elders just complain or say you're not welcome here rather than teaching. Because that young fella who's sitting here, based on what's going on, he's going to be dead in a week. And then it's too late. You can't say, I'll take you to a meeting or I'll show you how we do this. And I'm just watching it every day. And that's why I still do what I do for a living. I mean, God wants me doing this. If not, I'd be a plumber or something. But the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning and go to work, and sometimes it's just so much. There's just so much. You're surrounded with toxic and death. Is that I'm tired of burying young people. You're our future. Some of you are our future. And when I was doing a meeting at a treatment center last week, a young fellow I sponsored, can you come to my center? The kids love you. Come in and speak. I keep saying kids. I'm just getting old. That's all it is. I mean, 30 years old. 30 years old to me is a young guy. And based on what's going on out there, maybe 25, 30 young folks in there. Most of them are not going to make it through the year based on what's going on the street right now. What's going on the street right now makes the 60s in Harlem and the Upper West Side in the 60s look like a Disney cartoon. And when I was coming up and I heard about, I saw the older dope fiends on the street and occasionally somebody would OD. There was one guy, Dominic, who actually died in the schoolyard. They found him with a thing in the arm and everything. It just went through the neighborhood. This is a rare occurrence. How did that happen? We know he's we used to call him junkies. We know he's a junkie, but dead? 40 in Delray in a month. And what's frightening is, it's just like, yeah, well, that's the way it goes. And when we become numb to that, we are in deeper trouble than we think we are. It's kind of like when you watch the news, you know, murder, blowing up, kidnapping, and just bad stuff. Put on Seinfeld. You know, it doesn't even make a dent. If an alien landed and turned on a news station, he would say, you people are mad. Do you see what's going on? And that's what's happening. So I have a responsibility as an elder now. I'm not a newbie. As an elder in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor, Mark, you say, once you start lying to a drunk, your responsibility, you have a responsibility in their death. So it's not about making nice and warm fuzzies and hugs. I love you, you love me, I love you more, I love you more. And it's not about that. If that evolves, great. It's about giving a drunk the truth and exposing an addict who's in AA to this and making them feel welcome rather than sitting there saying, what are you doing here? Or making them feel more unwelcome, because that means we forgot about the fear we had walking in the door and how uncomfortable we were. And then lovingly taking them to maybe a place where they can identify more, or in the hope of saving their life, because that's what we're supposed to be doing here, saving lives with God's power and endurance. And if they flip me to bird, they flip me to bird. It's okay. At least I made the effort rather than just rolled over. Because if I had a son, I don't have children, but if I had a son, God forbid, who was a dopey and walked into AA and got treated like, well, those druggy buggies are not allowed in my meeting. You have to go, well, you're not welcome here. I'd come in and I'd have both guns loaded. You're killing my son. And if the elders in AA that everyone speaks so highly about AA is not even escorting them to a place that might be getting him real help, I would say, you know, you people are full of baloney. I don't want that to happen. Because this is the last house on the block for me, my Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it. This is what breeds life into me, and I want to keep it wholesome. I want to keep it clean. I want to keep it with highest integrity. I know those are false expectations, but that's how I do it. Which means I have to hold myself to that same kind of accountability. And I have a sponsor who makes sure I live up to that kind of standard. Keeping the bar raised high, because I'm an alcoholic still, and I'm flawed and I'm broken, and my illness wants to lower the bar. Just lower it. Meeting a month is good. You've meditated for 28 years, take a year off. And why sponsor people? You've sponsored enough. Now kick back, you know, you can hang out a little while. That's what my illness wants. My illness has a Here's after do a talk after a whole day like this, just says, get out of here. You don't need to get that well. In June 1988, I got into treatment for the seventh time. My success rate was just the worst. In six treatment centers, I managed 2 days of continuous sobriety over a number of years. Six treatment centers, 2 days of continuous sobriety on my own power. And after my fifth treatment center, I put down the non-conference approved dry goods. And I swore off liquor forever. And the little yellow and blue pills I was eating, done. And about 10 days before I was discharged from my fifth treatment center, after 9 weeks, I wasn't even thinking about drinking anymore. And I said, I'm done with that other stuff. I had abscesses all over me. I had marks behind my knee, in my thigh, my right foot. Had a big gash in it because everything else collapsed and I was trying to get in there. But that's when I was diagnosed with Hep C. And I weighed about 130 pounds. And I said, I'm done on the way in. And about 10 days before discharge, after 9 weeks of being discharged, I'm not even thinking about drinking. I love to drink. Oh, my God. But I'm not a drinker who goes into a bar and gets a nice pony glass or something fancy. You know, or those mugs that have the like little crystal around them, the nice little, you know, romantic way of drinking with a nice pinky ring. That's not me. I mean, I drank in bars for about 20 minutes. I don't like bars because I know I'm going to get thrown out. And if I get into a fight, I'm going to get leveled. and it's too expensive, and I drink till I pass out. So what I like to do is, when I had a license back then, is drink and drive, and if you got pulled over, the cops would just say, be careful. Wasn't like it is now. But I like just having a jug on me and just walking around drinking and finding, you know, some alleyway. I was like an animal. That's how I drink. Because I knew once I started drinking, I'm not stopping because it's getting late. In fact, the later it got into the night, less people out, that made me more nervous. I was more afraid because there was no one around. I had to drink even more. But I knew once I started, I'm not stopping. I know that's been established. Once I start, I am not stopping. So I'd find an alleyway or a stairway or an apartment building in a hallway, and I'd be that guy you walk and say, who's this person here? Maybe we should call the cops. And when I was somewhat coherent, I'd pretend I lived a, hi, how are you? We're just waiting for someone, or just something to leave me alone because it's cold out and I need to drink. Meanwhile, I have a really good family who lived in New York, in Staten Island at the time, a really good family. My dad's a warrior, tough guy, difficult to live with, but a good guy, family man, two brothers, loving grandparents, and here I am. There was something that was going on inside of me. This self-loathing. Someone touched on it today, and I can't remember who, but growing up, I felt different. Just couldn't fit in. I was a gifted musician, a really good athlete. I did good in school. You know, I got good grades. And I was brought up with good etiquette, how to shake hands to my elders, may I please, you know, things like that. Thank you. I was taught all those things. And my mom dressed me and my brothers, you know, really good. She taught us how to dress. I was given good hygiene rules from the get-go. But even with all of that, and lots of applause because I was a good musician, lots of attention and things like that, no matter what I did, I just, like, didn't feel good about me. Really not good about me. And I'd be hanging out with guys and, you know, on the basketball team or the baseball team. And, you know, they're just, you know, carrying on like guys do in a locker room or on the baseball field, just having some fun cutting up. And I kind of have one foot in it. But there was another voice saying, but you're you. You don't belong if they really knew about you. And between ages 8 and 10, I had some sexual abuse going on, and I felt like if they found that out, they just get rid of me. And it was just like, I don't do good here. I remember playing Little League baseball, and I just had this season as a kid that every kid would dream about. I was like the star guy on the team, and I got this trophy, like as high as this podium. I'm like 10 years old, and that's a 10-year-old's dream. And the next morning, it was back to being me again. You know? Mom was alcoholic and addicted to Valium, in and out of psych wards, in and out of psychiatrist offices, you know, suicide attempts. And my dad was a compulsive gambler and a gangster. You know, I was expected to beat people up at 5, not make peace. You know, I got street rules growing up from my dad. He meant well. He didn't want to see his oldest son get hurt, but he gave me street rules. And go get a job, forget about school, college. You went to college to be a doctor or a lawyer. That's it. There's no college. I remember telling my uncle, my guidance counselor, he didn't even know what a guidance counselor was. He thought this was a foreign language. And my guidance counselor told me I should take liberal arts. He says, you're going to college to learn how to draw? You know, that's where my family was with school. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I was homeless. I spent about 15 seconds in college. The College of Staten Island, CSI, College for Stupid Italians, that's me. And I, you know, it was just, I walked into that registration area, and I really felt like an alien. I was drunk, but I felt like an alien. I got to get out of here. And my music days were somewhat successful, and I got lots of applause in my music days, playing with people that, you know, I would see on album covers. and I had to be the greatest percussionist ever to hit the planet just to feel okay about me, just to feel somewhat okay. And I drink just to wash it all away. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, all my friends were married, had careers, and I'm homeless. And I couldn't drink enough to wash away the pain of the self-loathing, the mom committing suicide, and this guy who was cunning, baffling, and powerful, I called him Dad. And I said, why am I stuck with this? My brothers stopped talking to me. They were embarrassed, and they had hate for me, and I had hate for them. And the three of us were inseparable. That's what alcoholism does, by the way. It doesn't make friends. It destroys people. And my three brothers, me and my two brothers, the three of us, are extremely close today. And my alcoholism destroyed that. Yeah. My dad and I reconciled years ago. I mean, my dad and I get along fabulous. Sometimes I still get nervous around him. I think he just turned 80, but he has that way about him. It can intimidate. And if I'm not spiritually fit that day, I'll feel intimidated still. But we get along wonderfully. And we were as far as two people can be back in the day. And I took a couple of beatings from him in his effort to get me sober. I'll tell you what alcoholism does and drug addiction does. I'm going to share a story with you. It's not for shock value. You know, I don't want anyone to think my family of, you know, the raging lunatics. But what happens, what we do to people, the big book says years of living with an alcoholic make any child or wife neurotic. The whole family has become ill, to some extent ill. The big book was being kind when they said that. Because by the time God separated me in 1988 from alcohol, God willing for the last time, my family was suffering from full-blown alcoholism, which meant they were selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, and full of fear and a lot of rage. And we're in that place where we do irrational things. I do it to get another drink. They do it to save me from drinking. But they go blind. Now, my dad, I heard Marion talk about this a long time ago, and as recent as 2 weeks ago, that a parent, a mom would lay down her life for her children in a second. And my old man is the same thing for my brothers and myself. Even at our age now, we're men. We're not children. But if you got a call, it's you or your kids, my dad would say, take me, let's get it over with. That's the way he's made. And that very same guy found me in the worst of the worst neighborhoods. He used to go out driving looking for me and was going to shoot me. And he and my brother had the same line. We'd rather go to jail and we'll kill you than having those so-and-so drug dealers kill you. That's what they were brought to. So for me to get here and tell you just don't drink and go to meetings, you're not selfish. You're not blind to the truth. I am. This is about my belly's full and they can do whatever they want now. They should be grateful I'm sober. Not necessarily. I need to make that right. Somehow, some way, make it right where they sleep at night and those kind of hostile thoughts I can help them process through because they have guilt and remorse about the things. Anyone in Al-Anon in here tonight know exactly what I'm talking about. We will say things. I've been in Al-Anon for a handful of years when I first got here. We will say things and do things and feel about people and think things about people that when we finally see them sober, we say, oh, my God, I couldn't believe I did that and said that. And my job as a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous is help them with that. By letting them sleep tonight, by making the call to say, yes, I'm here now. Yes, I'm home now. I will be there for Thanksgiving and be there for Thanksgiving. Not be fashionably late because my ego is still flourishing. Get there on time and do what I say and say what I do. That kind of stuff. Because God's infectious. God will spread too. So after, you know, six treatment centers, I'm in the streets. And doing what you do in the streets. I was living in an abandoned building in the back of a hallway, and I come out like a vampire at night, hustle up some money, sneak my head out during the day. I knew what I looked like. I knew what I smelled like, and I didn't want anybody to be around me now. And I didn't want anyone around. And I remember coming out of a blackout on, I think it's Jefferson and Rutgers, somewhere on the Lower East Side, East Broadway down there. And it was pouring, raining. And I'm standing underneath the storefront. And I don't know how I got there, but I'm missing my jacket and my shoes. I'm barefoot. And I have no jacket. And what am I doing here? And now what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to walk the streets? How am I going to hustle up money? I have no shoes. And it's cold out, cold rain, and I have no jacket. And I can't put it together. And I'm panicking. What did I do? Where have I been? I don't know what to do. And then you roll over once you get a jug and you forget about it. And you start walking the streets barefoot until you get your hands on some shoes. Stealing was just a regular thing, by the way. It was just a regular practice. You steal. You're on the streets, you steal. I mean, that's just the way it goes. And hoping not to get picked up by the police, because if you went into the system, that means you're in the system for at least 3 days, and you know you're going to be detoxing while you're in the system, and the COs beat you up when you say, I need a doctor. I don't want that. So you're walking around with a pending doom and paranoia, and there it is. And this is what I owned and owned me, my alcoholism. The great thing about this fellowship that we belong to, and even more so the program of Alcoholics Anonymous inside the fellowship, it speaks so loudly for the power that we cannot be spoken about. And so I get into my 7 treatment center through a series of circumstances, and I'm in there, and I'm done. I'm done again. I'm so done. And 10 days later, I got thirsty again. But this time, something kept me in there not to sign out. Oh, I was going to sign out, fill out the form to sign out. I was doing it. But something kept my hands, if you will, in my pockets. It was that God buffer. And they sent me out to Minnesota, and while I was out there, I was brought to a meeting called the Three Legacies Meeting, and I saw people I never saw before. Clean looking, integrity, humility, service people, a literature table that was the length of this whole wall. Just stuff. A big circle and a triangle and a big podium, and people would get up. Their men had shirt and ties on. The women had suits on. They had a big book. They looked impeccable, clean and neat, clean shaven to go give a talk. No baseball hat behind the podium. Took it off. They got called up to do notes. You see the hat go on the table. I said, what's that about? It's called respect, they told me. I said, okay, I got it. I like this. I had some structure finally. And more importantly, I didn't look sober. I didn't sound sober. You know what they said? Keep coming back. We'll see you next week. Keep coming back. We'll see you next week. I didn't feel worthy to sit in the front row. It was a guy, Chuck Rice, one of my first heroes. The old timers back then always called you kid. How you doing, kid? I mumbled something. He's come with me. And he moved me up to where he was, maybe in the second, third row. Oh, my God, I was so uncomfortable there. They're all staring at me. That's the guy from New York, careful. But there I was sitting next to Chuck Rice, who was like Mickey Mantle over there. And he was like a caring parent, like a real elder. Give me little pearls. Give me little pearls. I didn't feel dirty around him. I didn't feel dirty around those people. I felt dirty when I went home to my sober house. And I was brought home after almost a year, and I was taken to the Free Spirit group, the same group I was there really drunk and critiqued a speaker one night, and the people then said, keep coming back. But there I am at the Free Spirit group, and I met my first teacher, Tony N., and he was a bulldog of bulldogs. Wasn't well-liked by a lot of people in the community because he was a big book guy and a bulldog about it. He spoke his mind. And that spirit says, go ask him. And we began a journey. And I remember saying to him, Tony, you know, there's all these different fourth steps I see. Mary's doing this fourth step. Joe's doing this pamphlet over here. And he had a way of addressing me that I can't use because there's women in the room. But he says, where in the big book do you see these pamphlets and formats? I said, nowhere. He says, then get rid of them. We're going out of the big book. And so he began from the cover. I remember him showing me the basic text pages, 1 to 164, remain unchanged. This is the AA message. That was on the cover, the inside cover of the third edition. I don't know if it's in the fourth edition. By the way, you know that fourth edition had to revise a couple of times because somebody dropped the ball when that fourth edition came out? like a meeting online will replace what we're doing tonight, a few other things. Let's pray AA doesn't become politically correct, huh? And I learned a whole lot from this man. And about 10 years into that relationship, Mark H. showed up and my whole life changed. And what has happened, and I'll just want to push this because it's been a long day. What has happened, I learned, I got to look at AA and the program inside the fellowship from a different angle. I had a good teacher. Very fundamental, basic lessons, which is what I needed. He was very much into meditation, and he taught me some of that. And there was a woman outside of AA who taught me about meditation. I felt that was feeding my soul, and that's why I'm still a seeker today and always meditating and doing a lot of prayer and reading and working with books. I say work with them, not study them, because we can study any book and forget it a year later, but working with them so the book becomes who we be. The big book becomes who we be now. A walking example is a big book. I don't have to remember a page or a quote. It's who I be. Living examples of his power. And but I got to see AA. I got to study traditions. I got to study our history. And I took he made me look at even inventory at an angle I never saw before. And I really got the importance through Mark's teachings and Don's teachings and my whole lineage of what was going on here. Why we do this work. And it was attraction and not promotion. And how I speak from this podium. Because there's women in the room. And if I think, well, they're in AA, no, you learn how to have respect for women because you always disrespected women. So mind your tongue. And I need to be really mindful about a newcomer in the meeting, too, that this doesn't sound like a bar room either. That's how I was taught. That's my story. People have other stories. And I wasn't the brightest bulb in the box, and they knew that, so they spoon-fed me stuff. And then something happened. Through meditation experiences, through prayer experiences, knowing that I'm known by my Creator, watching prayer bring death, as another book says, to every identity that doesn't come from this power called God, because we walk around with all these false identities who we think we are, we're supposed to be, I'm supposed to sound, and it goes on and on and on. We're playing all these roles depending on who's in the room. You're giving a talk and someone walks in the room and right away you get nervous. You forget what you're going to say because you're playing a role. That's why. I got to sound a certain way because Joe just walked in. He's going to critique me. No, he's not. You're critiquing him. But if it's just be me, what God created, warts and all. Suddenly when Joe walks in the room, oh, hi, Joe. This is me. I don't have to pretend anymore. What a great amount of freedom just to, here I am. You know, cracks in the armor, lots of mistakes, but this is me. But striving to get well, God's begging to have a relationship with every one of us. God's pursuing every one of us. We were born to be saints. At time I start acting like one. Big book says we are not saints. No kidding. I'll let you listen to my fourth step. You know I'm not a saint. But that doesn't mean I cop to not trying to achieve enlightenment in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I can just roll over. I know I'm flawed. I know I'm broken. But that's not an excuse just to roll over and not do anything and be apathetic. It's about striving for oneness with God, enlightenment in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know you're not supposed to say this, but it's my truth. We do have gurus in AA. We have enlightened men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do. We have our heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God we do. Thank God we have enlightened people in AA, oneness, experiencing true oneness with God. The gurus in AA, we have them. We're not putting them on a pedestal. Everyone's got clay feet, but those people, whether usually the elders, who are in this book, in traditions, just their whole life is this. There's something different about them. Don P. was one. Mark H. was one. And some people didn't like them. There's another AA camp that didn't like them. I don't care. That's their fight. That's what we get to experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's way beyond just going to a meeting for me. I get to be a part of the sacred fellowship, get to do this program. I get to give it all away in service. It's even beyond that because we're talking about God. And once I touch my humanness and my faults, I'm able to do godly things, not God, but godly things and transcend all of this. This is way beyond going to a local home group. This is about really walking experientially. Can we talk about what it's like living in the world of the Spirit? That's what we're that's what the book talks about. We've entered the world of the Spirit experientially. Can we talk about that? What does that feel like? Doesn't mean life's not going to be problematic anymore. Doesn't mean I'm not going to have a little uncertainty and doubt. The carpenter had uncertainty and doubt. That means when I come along, I'm going to have uncertainty and doubt. Okay, great. What am I doing about it? Going right back to God. I have uncertainty and doubt. So communication with God, constant contact with God, conscious contact with God is pretty much my life, pretty much Marion's life. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I know it sounds lame to a newcomer. I don't have a life. It's none of my business. My life belongs to my Creator. Had something happen to me. I don't believe I'm going to get to share this here, but do you ever have a dream where it's so real when you wake up, you're wondering, was that a dream? That just happened. That just really happened. And it stays with you. During the day, you're like, wait a minute. And I had to seek counsel from my sponsor. Since I was in Houston. I called my sponsor. We've been speaking on different days because Wednesdays he's involved with his church right now. Till actually we go back on Wednesdays again this Wednesday. So I called him on Saturday and I was like, I got to share this experience. I don't know what to do with this. And that something happened to me where my Creator came to me and there was a discussion about the offense of the cross. And my Creator, my God came to me and said these words, would you die for me? And I said, yes. I said a different phrase, but that's my agreed immediately. And as soon as I said that, I remember waking up and I felt pain from my wrists up to my shoulders. It was excruciating pain. I wasn't sleeping on my arms where, you know, you do that and you wake up and your arm falls asleep and it hurts. I was sleeping on my back and I woke up in the most god-awful pain in my arms, like someone was just sticking a nail through it. It was just terrible. That's where I am with my God. I need to lose my life to God. And when I lose my life to God, I find it. If I try to find my life, I will lose it. And that's from another book. So that's where I am with this God, who I walk on most days in a spirit of gratitude and confidence, dependence upon Him. And go in any lengths to experience more of Him and to do His work. And I guess you only know that if you walk with me. You don't have to believe me on face value here, but you can walk with me. And I'm not perfect. I have lots of things, you know, a lot of flaws, a lot of broken pieces. But that's where I am in spirit and emotion with this, my dedication to God. And that doesn't make me a better AA. It's just where God has molded me, and what a tremendous amount of freedom to get to worship my God freely in front of you and to worship my Alcoholics Anonymous with all the broken pieces in here freely and not be ashamed of that and to shout about God from the rooftops and my love for Alcoholics Anonymous and not have false humility when I say I don't have a life that belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what happened to my life without you guys. And I'll just, you know, close with this. I shared this. I think I said it this afternoon. I'm not sure. Another one of those God speaking to us, and it stays with us, and God puts his hand on your heart, his thumb on your heart, and you don't have to remember. And it just came to me how God wants our soul. That's all He wants. Just wants your soul. You give Him our soul in desperation, and He gives me a life. I give Him my life, and He gives me purpose. Never had that before. Gives me purpose. I give Him my sins. He gives me forgiveness. I gave Him my drunkenness. He gave me sobriety. I give Him my sobriety. He gives me Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm ever grateful. That's all I got. Peace.
Thank you, Peter, and I'd like to thank Peter and the rest of the speakers, Pat, Marion, Mike Chase, Russell's gone, Tom, I thank all of you from the bottom of my heart for being here today and sharing this experience with us and your time with us. And I thank everybody who stuck it out for the day and all the people that didn't stick it out for the day for being here. If anybody care to stay to help clean up, that would be great. And thank you, God. We're going to end this meeting with the Lord's Prayer, remembering that it starts with our Father and ends with Amen. Circle up.
Roy, you want to take us out?
Can we have a moment of silence for the sick and suffering inside and outside of these rooms? All of our Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
So close.